Welcome, welcome, welcome. You're listening to the B-Team Overstated Podcast, the most prestigious B-Team podcast in the world. With me today, I've got brother Ethan with me. Ethan, it's wonderful to see you. How are you doing today this morning on a beautiful Sunday morning my time, noon your time. How's it going today, Ethan?
Well, Adler, I'm excited to be here on a Sunday morning with you. Obviously, our original plan was to record Friday night. Things got away from us a little bit after game four, but I'm happy to say that today the B and B team stands for brunch. I got myself a little nice hefty pour of a mimosa here. I'm having myself a gorgeous start to my day here in Minneapolis. What is going on in Northern California?
That was a big cup of mimosa right there. I got a little Mr. Leahy vibe coming from you here, so I appreciate that. I would say it's a beautiful sunny day, but you can't see with the listeners, but in the background here, I got wind. I got some sprinkles. It is still borderline winter here, and I don't understand what's going on. I thought global warming was real, but you know what? We're not a scientific pod. We're not going to get into that today.
Exactly. The only thing I'm getting into is, like you said, this hefty pour of mimosa here. I've got Always Sunny is back on my tube, so I rewatched the episode recently where Charlie and Frank are going out and you got to ask somebody why they'd want to drink straight mixer. And, I don't want to start my day that way for sure, especially on a Sunday with no basketball. I got no plans today. Let's get after it. Let's do a nice little podcast for you.
All right. Well, without further ado, I think the main thing on the top of the list here is, we've got a finals going on here. We had game four a couple days ago. We've got game five coming up. When is that? Is that tonight? Is that tomorrow? That's one of the two.
We're going to figure that out.
It's an early morning here still for me. But anyways, we both watched game four. We both saw Denver go up 3-1. What are you thinking here? You rewatched it this morning, so it's a little bit more fresh in your head here. So, give me a couple things that kind of stood out to you where like, is Miami going to be able to extend this at all, or is this a wrap?
So first of all, I want to shout out to Steve and Brett for coming in a little bit later this week with the Game 3 podcast and finally giving my guy, and I want to say my guy for Steve, who tried to gatekeep him from me, my dude Christian Braun, his flowers. So
you're not even going to say his last name correctly?
Brown, whatever the heck it is. I sounded out phonetically based on the spellings, but it's Christian Braun. It's Christian Braun. It's interchangeable, man. All that matters is that guy was balling out in Game 3. I'm very, very excited to see him continue to move forward. Unfortunately, game four wasn't his game, but game four, let me tell you, I watched it again this morning, like you already mentioned. And, we go back to that role player draft we did last week, and I shocked the world by taking Bruce Brown with my last pick. And let me tell you something, Bruce Brown put the Heat in the coffin at the end of game four there. 9 points in the last 4 minutes, couple of big threes, a beautiful and one on a reach and foul by Caleb Martin, where he wasn't even looking at the ball. I don't even know what he was thinking there when he hacked him. But Bruce Brown put the game away. I want to give him his flowers as we kind of talk through the events of this game. And also Aaron Gordon, let me tell you something. That kid had a phenomenal game, lived up to his number four pick potential from that 2014 draft. And it was a role player's game in game four. And the team with a better squad ended up pulling away and winning that game in the fourth quarter for sure.
Yeah, and it's hard to win a role players game when you're Miami and your role players are shooting 0-7 for three. Gabe Vincent, Max Strus, combined. I mean, Duncan Robinson did his thing here, but Vincent and Strus are they are not performing the way they did in the Eastern Conference Finals there, and that really is the big difference here in each and every one of these games. Is everyone keeps saying Miami can't keep shooting this way. Miami can't keep doing this. They kept doing it, and then they hit the finals, and they stopped doing it.
And that's the thing too that I've noticed so far with Gabe Vincent as well. Like obviously in game two and game one, he was balling out, averaging 21.5 points a game, just completely dominating and getting to his spots and doing what he's been doing. But there's just been a lid on the basket ever since they went on down to South Beach, especially for those guys. You mentioned Strus and Vincent. Caleb Martin managed to kind of scrape together a halfway decent performance in the last game. Same with Duncan Robinson down the stretch. But again, like, when you've got your two starters who you rely on for a vast majority of your three-point shooting in your starting lineup, you need those guys to perform well. And, they didn't even shoot that poorly in that game, 32% from three, 8-for-25. But, again, Denver, just an absolute mauling by those guys that you want to rely on. And they managed to overcome, like, a pretty shaky Jamal Murray game. But I still want to give him his flowers, too, as we kind of get through the rest of this game here. But where did you look at this game and kind of realize, man, this is – because it was really close for a while. Like, we were midway through the third quarter. Everything was going okay. But all of a sudden, Denver does that thing that they've been doing all playoffs. And you look up and they're up 17. It's ridiculous.
It really, I mean, with most teams, I would say, you know, start of the fourth, kind of right in that range. But with Miami and the zombie heat and what they've been doing this year, I mean, I still believe it was within 10 points with roughly 3 to 4 minutes left. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but I think that was kind of a general realm there. And with Miami, you go, I'm not counting them out. So I think this is the one team where I wasn't counting them out until they were down, you know, whatever it was, 12, 13, 14 with a couple minutes left there. But I mean, I believe in this team until the very end. But I think you brought up something really important is they didn't perform in Miami. And this is an underdog team. This is a chip on your shoulder team. So I think if we're going to look at the keys to, you know, how can they extend the series? I think the number one keys, aren't they going back to Denver game five?
Yeah, they're absolutely going back.
Everyone's, they seem to thrive when everyone hates them in wherever arena they're in. You know, that seems to be their calling card. But having said that, any other team, any other series, I'm saying Denver gentlemen sweep. This is just a weird zombie Heat team. And one more thing that I wanted to kind of touch on here, shout out Aaron Gordon, local legend, San Jose kid. I think this just goes back to the importance, and we've got the draft coming up here. You know, I know we're going to get into some more draft talk as we get a little bit closer to it. I think it's just so important, the fit of wherever these kids end up going. And it's not just pure. I mean, you look at Aaron Gordon, and I mean, if you were to tell me right now, if you were to say, hey, Denver, you can either have the number four pick in this year's draft, or you can have what Aaron Gordon is doing for you right now. I think they would choose Aaron Gordon 10 out of 10 times, right? But I think leading up to the trade to Denver, you might look at Aaron Gordon and say, man, what a bust of a pick right there. I mean, they tried to make him mini LeBron in Orlando. And it's like, I just want to keep that in mind. You look at the Andrew Wiggins swap to Golden State. You look at Gordon to Denver, just what these change of sceneries do, what the change of role, what the change of fit does. And I just think we need to really keep that in mind with this upcoming draft here. You know, there's multiple reasons why a guy can be either deemed a bust or deemed disappointing in their draft slot. And it's not always their fault. And I think Aaron Gordon is a spectacular example of that right now. And I just all credit to him for what he's doing. He is performing at a level that should be performing at and exceeded it.
Yeah. And that's the big thing too, is like there, like you said, there are plenty of stories of those lottery picks who get drafted into a situation where it's not ideal and they end up going to a new situation and they end up thriving. Like Andrew Wiggins for your team is a phenomenal example. In Minnesota, he was depended on to be the number one guy. He tried to perform like a number one guy, but ultimately that doesn't translate to what some people might call as winning basketball. You plop him into a system like the Golden State Warriors did. You put him in, he doesn't have to be that primary or even that secondary option. He can kind of just focus on defense, get open on cuts, shoot when he's open, and also play make a little bit on ball. And that's a lot what Aaron Gordon's been asked to do as well. If you even look back to how the Lakers have performed during the playoffs, like what Rui Hachimura had to do off the bench, that he was drafted to Washington to be a marquee player and try to be a star. Ultimately, that just doesn't work for some players. But I'd much rather watch somebody in a situation like Aaron Gordon or Rui Hachimura or Andrew Wiggins go to a scenario where they can succeed and perform well, but not have to be burdened with the responsibility of being that number one or even that number two guy. There's probably a podcast somewhere down the road here, maybe when we get into the grit and grind of this summer, where we might maybe look at some role players, guys who are drafted in the top 10, maybe see if we can trade them to a different team. That might be a fun podcast to do. I'm going to write that down so we can kick that can around down the road.
I love it. We're making magic on the spot here and just kind of doing a quick, again, we're not going to go super deep into the draft here. That's for another time, but just looking at a couple different prospects on the top 10, I could just see this happening right away. I mean, you look at Jairus Walker right there. I mean, that is a guy that screams, I should be an all-star role player, but he's going to go top six, top seven. And the casual fan is going to look at a guy like that for their team and go, why aren't you the number one guy? Why aren't you, you know, why aren't you mini LeBron right now? And, you know, I just think we should look out for that and have a little patience with these guys here. But shout out Aaron Gordon, local legend, NorCal guy. He is balling out right now. And he's definitely proving that he was worth the initial investment that the Magic put into him.
The one thing I did want to touch on with Aaron Gordon, yeah, though, as well, is just I obviously watched the game this morning. It's a little bit more fresh. But one thing that Miami has done this whole series is sag off Aaron Gordon from three-point land. And obviously, Aaron Gordon is not a phenomenal shooter. He can knock him down if and when he needs to. But obviously, if you're working at a highly switchable offense when you need to claps on Jokic or Murray or even Michael Porter Jr. at times, you're okay leaving Aaron Gordon open in the corner. There were a couple plays that stuck out to me. One was in, I want to say it was the second quarter. They're swinging the ball around, a lot of confusion on the switch. KCP's at the top of the right key. He throws a lob pass to a cutting Gordon from the left corner. Gorgeous alley-oop slam, and nobody was even close to him on that dunk. Same thing a couple of quarters later. Corner three-pointers. Aaron Gordon knocked down three of four threes. The fourth three he chucked up was a desperation heave at the end of the shot clock that he probably wasn't feeling comfortable taking at all. I know I wouldn't have been. But he ends that game 11 for 15. When you have one of your players who, and we've talked a little bit already about how Miami is a lot smaller in the series, especially when they have to move to play guys like Caleb Martin or Duncan Robinson as kind of like a switchable three and four when you got all those wings running around, that's when Gordon's able to capitalize. And it's like you said, it's phenomenal to see a guy like that succeed on a pretty high usage rate for him. 15 shots, 11 for 15, got to the line a couple of times with a couple of and ones. It was great to watch him succeed in a game, especially when I just rehashed what I thought the conditions of that Denver trade were. They traded him for RJ Hampton, a slightly protected first round pick, and Gary Harris. Like, that's just a dump a contract trade. And now he's playing massive minutes for a team that's probably one win away from their first NBA Finals victory.
Yeah, man, that's almost as good as the Andrew Wiggins and Jonathan Kuminga for D'Angelo Russell trade. But
hey, it worked out for everybody.
We'll another time. You know, one thing to kind of just touch back on our last pod, we did that Finals role players draft, right? And I mean, one, you took current day Bruce Brown. I didn't know we were taking current players, but one thing we both overlooked was current day Aaron Gordon. And, you know, when I was looking back at some of those role players, one of the things that I was really looking for is, you know, what guys stepped it up in the playoffs and the finals compared to what they did in the regular season. And I'm not saying Aaron Gordon is, you know, he's a Hall of Famer in the playoffs and a dud in the I'm not saying that or anything, but you just kind of look at the splits here. He is playing a lot more in the playoffs. He's playing six more minutes per game. He's showing a lot more durability. He's showing, you know, the endurance is there, the cardio is there, you know, the ability to hustle, all that stuff is there. This is the big thing right here. He improved his three-point shooting from 35% in the regular season to 40% in the playoffs. You're telling me that I can get a 6'9 guy who's going to be the number one perimeter defender, who can also defend the low post with most players, and he's going, you know, and like you said, a streaky three-point shooter, a shaky three-point shooter, he's going to shoot 40% from three for me? Like, sign me up all day long. That's just the sign of a winner. That's the sign of a guy who prepared, who cared, and you know, who played the X factor. I mean, obviously, Nikolai, Jamal, they're the modern day Kobe, Shaq. Maybe some would say better, you know, but you need a guy like Aaron Gordon. You need that high level elite Swiss Army knife role player. You need that Iggy, that Wiggins, and Gordon's doing it for them this year. So just shout out Aaron Gordon.
Absolutely. Can we give Bruce Brown some flowers here too, man? Talk about a good way to end the game for Bruce Brown. A couple of things I noticed. Jokic picks up his fifth foul with about 10 minutes left to go in the fourth quarter. And everyone has been shouting ad nauseum for years and years that the off-court Jokic minutes are just god-awful and they're bad. And all of a sudden we look at where Denver is at that point when Jokic comes out of the game. They're up by 10 points, but there's still plenty of time left on the clock for Miami to start making that run. And they eventually do. So Jimmy Butler gets an and one with about 8:42 left, cuts the lead down to five. But all of a sudden, these role players, Aaron Gordon included, Bruce Brown down the stretch, 9 points in the final 4 minutes for him. He just decided to light him up. And that's what I really appreciated about how this team works together as a unit. It's not offensive. They can switch their defense on at any time, like especially like in a game where Jamal Murray shot really, really poorly from the field. It was their defense that came up clutch. KCP had a couple of awesome plays on Jimmy Butler, Bruce Brown locking guys down. They just let Miami or stop Miami from making shots. And ultimately, it's a make or miss league. And that's what I think really spun game four was the role players coming in and turning it on.
I'm a little surprised right now because you started that little rant by saying, you know, shout out to Bruce Brown for what he did, you know, at the end of the game here. I thought you were talking about when he met up with the Kevinder twins afterwards. I thought that's what you meant by Bruce Brown stays winning. You know, I mean, I just, he is clearly the most impactful player of this entire series so far. And if you want a reference to that, you can go back and listen to the last pod, but shout out Bruce Brown. Let's give our quick predictions for the rest of this series and for game five. And then we got a fun little topic that we're going to get on after this. So Ethan, take it away. Does Miami extend this or does it end tomorrow night?
if they're going to extend it, it's going to come with their three starters performing well. What I want to see more in game five, if this is a kitchen sink game for Miami, I want to see more Kevin Love minutes. That's a weird little thing that I kind of wanted to sprinkle in. There was a little stretch in the third quarter in game four where Kevin Love scored 9 straight points. And he was getting to the rim. He was capitalizing on switches. There was one play where he drove right past Michael Porter Jr. and got to the rim for an and one. That was like peak Minnesota Kevin Love. Yeah, it was awesome to watch. Like, maybe not Minnesota Kevin Love because he was a little bit chunky. I don't think his perimeter quickness was as good when he was hanging up in Minnesota. But again, like, he's a solid player that can knock guys down. And if you need somebody to like stay inside and muscle up with somebody, he was going at Aaron Gordon. He was going at Michael Porter Jr. I want to see a little bit more than 18 minutes out of Kevin Love, even if the matchups aren't ideal. And also, like we've already mentioned before, Max Strus and Gabe Vincent got to get it together. They got to start knocking something down. I don't know if it's just the fear of the moment. Each of them picked up 3 fouls really early in the second half. So I think that definitely impacted Strus's defense a little bit, just in how he's able to stay physical and kind of get after guys. You can't be afraid of that moment. 3 fouls in the second half, it's not a deal breaker. Like, you've still got a couple more to kind of go after. And especially if you're a guy like Spoelstra, I want you to be able to empower your guys to just hack somebody if you need to, like, send a message, prove a point. Like, there was one play that I mentioned as well. Jokic and Strus got tied up on an offensive rebound. They ended up getting hooked up together. And I wrote down WWGWD, and that stands for what would Grant Williams do in that situation? If you're Grant Williams and you're tied up with Jokic on an offensive rebound, I need you to fall to the floor screaming like you just got shot by somebody up in the upper deck. Max Strus kind of just sit there with his hands up doing whatever. Obviously, we don't want an entire game of over embellishment, but if this is a kitchen sink game, you need to sell the physicality of what this doughy Serbian is doing to you on the inside of the basketball court. Like, obviously that's what you need to do. I want to see them embellish a little bit more.
Well, and two quick stats, and then I'm going to get your predictions here, but just to kind of go with what you're saying, first stat, Max Strus, I believe he's shooting 20% on wide open threes in the finals. That's just not going to get it done. It's just not. The other stat here is, I believe 100% of all teams who were down 3-1 in the finals who came back and won had Kevin Love on their team. I believe that's the stat here. That hurts me to say too, by the way. That, I mean, like, I'm really humbling myself right now just to even admit that on the podcast, but just wanted to throw that out there. So give me, you know, we got the analysis, you know, we got the recap. Give me your prediction. What do you think happens here?
I said on the last podcast we did right at the end of the role player draft, when we did our quick little final predictions, I think it's Denver at 5. I think it's over. But like I said, in order for it to be over, you need Denver to have a bad shooting night. And ultimately they kind of did in this series, or in this last one, at least with their role guys. Jamal Murray had a bad game. Jokic was in foul trouble. He tweaked his ankle in the first quarter, but he seems okay. You need to continue to keep going at these guys, and you need to make them work for a gentleman's sweep here. What do you think, Adler? What's your thought? Are we going back to Miami on Thursday?
At the beginning of the series, I said Miami in 7, so I'm going to stick with my word. As Draymond says, what does he say? He says, like, stand up for what you say, you know, believe in what you say. So I'm going to stick with Miami in 7. Having said that, the gift of hindsight is telling me Denver in 5. For the record, I'm going to say Miami in 7. I'm going to stick with what I said, but I would not be surprised if what you said came true here. So, all right. I think ultimately we're going to see a celebration in Denver Monday night. But you know what? Hey, let's hope for a 7-game series just for the sake of the fans here.
Can I do a little tinfoil hat moment? There was one thing that took place near the end of the third quarter. In wrestling, I want to shout out my guy, Adam. Bret Hart ended up losing the title in Toronto to Shawn Michaels, obviously back in the 90s, SummerSlam. That was referred to as the Montreal Screwjob. With 2 minutes left in the third quarter of the game on Friday night, the Miami rim job took place. And I want to talk about what happened with that rim, the stoppage in play for 10 minutes. Bam Adebayo goes up for a dunk and hangs on the rim for just a little bit too long. We end up breaking out the level. We ended up breaking out the ladders. We had a woman escorted out of the arena with either a medical emergency or maybe had a few too many rum and cokes.
I was going to say, Bam dunked it so hard, he gave that lady a stroke. It was wild.
It was definitely wild, but
I'll praise her.
I feel like the game definitely shifted when you've got 8 minutes off and you're just standing there. That was a point in time where Miami was starting to come back just a little bit. There was an ESPN zoom in on the level, on the rim for about 30 seconds of time as you watch that little bubble go back and forth. That's just an S-tier sports moment in history. So I want to get the Miami rim job trending. I know that might be a different thing. Please don't Google that on your work computers. At the end of the day, I think that's the primary reason they ended up winning game four. I think that rim was still just a little bit off kilter, might have affected some shots down the
stretch. Quick shout out to that camera guy too. My roommate, his daddy's been a cameraman operator in Hollywood for his whole life. So he gets real nerdy about some real cool camera shots on live TV at times. And when we saw that pop up, we were standing up, standing ovation to that cameraman. That he earned his entire paycheck with that shot right there.
Yeah. You know, some guy in the production truck is just like, get a shot on the level quick. We need to make sure that this is good to go.
That was amazing. All right. We got another fun little topic here to discuss here. So let's move on. We had some wild news about Chris Paul release earlier this week, and I'm not talking about his affair with Kim Kardashian. I am talking about the Suns affair with possibly waiving him. So the initial report was that he was getting waived. I believe that was Chris Haynes that tweeted that out. And then Shams and Woj immediately backtracked and were like, wait a minute. He's not officially waived yet. We might, you know, he might be waived. This might be a sign-in trade. He might be waived and re-signed. But we have until, I think, June 26th, somewhere in that June 28th, kind of in that realm there, to make this decision, which clearly means what Phoenix is trying to do is just put the feelers out. You know, just they said it on the Bill Simmons pod. It's a tester fart in the car just to see, like, hey, how are people going to react to this one? So it was discussed a little bit on the 18 pod. You know, I know they brought up like a couple trade ideas here, but you know what? We're going to do a little bit of a deeper dive on that today. So we're going to do kind of like, What are your favorite CP3 landing spots? What are your ideal CP3 landing spots? And for the record, everyone, we are not cap experts. We are not Bobby Marks. You know, we don't know if he's going to get waived. We don't know if it's going to be a sign-in trade. So financially speaking, I'm going to be a little loose on this, and I'm more just kind of looking for like team fit. Where do you want to see him play? Who do you want to see him play with? That type of thing. So I've got a little list compiled up here. I can definitely give my first team, but I'd love to get your thoughts on this as well. Before we get into the teams here, I mean, do you have any just thoughts on that wild tweet to begin with? Just the fact that they're even thinking about waiving him? Did that do anything for you here?
I mean, as far as the initial tweet, like you said, the first initial reaction across the league and across Twitter was just genuine shock. And obviously, when you look at a guy in Chris Paul who's been the big reason for a lot of team success around the league, whether it's when he went to Oklahoma City and dragged that team to the playoffs and was really influential in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's development, when he ended up in Phoenix and really kind of worked as kind of like a Batman and Robin and Devin Booker, how he's worked with DeAndre Ayton on his pick and roll game. Obviously, from a mentorship standpoint, Chris Paul is a valuable, valuable asset. And so just letting him go for seemingly nothing was pretty egregious, and kind of obviously your first knee-jerk reaction is, oh my God, there's a new owner, there's a new coach, we just need a clean house, we want to retool. And obviously with the salary cap hits coming up with the new CBA, obviously not going to get into the weeds on that there. It just seemed like a cost-cutting measure. It seemed like something you'd see in the NFL, where you have a guy who's owed a lot of money still left on his contract, but you just feel more comfortable with cutting him as opposed to kind of continuing to carry that asset, just to kind of have more flexibility and malleability as you head into a free agency summer where there aren't a lot of marquee guys available. So $40 million that you're paying Chris Paul could be salary for three, possibly four role guys that you can bring in to really bolster that bench, which is where I think Phoenix really struggled, especially as it got later and later into that Denver series with more and more guys going down. Like, Jock Landale's not it. Shout out to the Australians, but you need to bolster that unit and really capitalize on whatever you have left of Booker and KD. So that was reaction number one. Reaction number two, when they ran it back, was, okay, this seems like something Chris Paul would do. Chris Paul would be okay with getting waived and coming back in a team-friendly contract if this is a team he enjoys playing with, which it seems like it is. If you're able to retool your contract so it's a little bit more malleable and you're able to even make a couple of moves as opposed to three or four, that's something that I feel like he would do as well. But again, like, as we move towards this new CBA where you only get a couple of max slots and there's going to be a really aggressively hardly taxed cap, people can't be getting paid $40 million anymore if they're not the marquee guys in the league. Like, obviously Chris Paul is a legacy, but this is going to affect people across the league. Like, if James Harden starts to go look for a new contract, if he wants that max money, I don't think anybody wants to do it if what we see in the CBA is true. So if he ends up going anywhere, it's going to be on a team-friendlier deal as he kind of winds down on the twilight of his career. And I'm really interested to see where you want him to go. I've got a couple ideas, but what was on your list in terms of where you want this man to land?
Well, first, I think that the comparison to the NFL contracts is brilliant. I think that's a great point because, I mean, there's such a difference in how we approach contracts with the NFL stars compared to basketball stars with the guaranteed aspect of it. And while that is great for player security and that is very player friendly in the NBA, and I think ultimately that's what we are all rooting for. I think the vast majority of us are team player versus, you know, team owner or something like that. It does create these scenarios in which when you are not performing at that level anymore, you become an albatross for your team and they have to start making moves that maybe on a personal level or on a historic level, they wouldn't do otherwise. And so I think that's a really good point. And also on top of that, you know, in the NFL, if you have a quarterback who, you know, maybe has a little bit of a play style change or maybe their quality of play has dropped off a little bit, you can restructure that contract. You can't really do that in the NBA. Also, just for the record, I have never once heard of a player getting waived and then signing back with that same team right again. I'm not saying it hasn't happened. I'm not a historian, but that's wild to me. I haven't really heard that. So number one on my list, I have re-sign with the Suns, and my notes on it say, don't understand this one. But he clearly loves those guys. So, I mean, I think ultimately, if this is purely just a salary cap thing, which I think, you know, you brought that up, and I think that's really is what this boils down to. You know, I'm not the first to bring this up, but the league is basically going into this world in which you are going to have two Ferraris, and then you're going to have a bunch of little $10,000 beater cars, and that's pretty much how your salary cap's going to have to get structured. CP3 is not a Ferrari anymore. He's a very, very solid midsize, maybe 20-year-old Volvo sedan or something like that. You want him for your kid. It's going to be safe. It's going to be dirt. You know, it's going to be reliable. It's going to get the job done, but it is not a Ferrari anymore. So while I do have the Suns on that list, I think, you know, ultimately I think they do love him. I think he does love those guys. I think the fit is still fine there. I think he can still definitely play a productive role on that team with the star power they have. But again, I've just never heard of a guy getting waived and then re-signing with that same team. I don't know how that works. So that leads me to my first actual, transactional trade here. And that is the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Shut up.
Minnesota Timberwolves.
What is this?
I'm just saying, look, here's what my notes say. Hey, okay, if you're going to do this deal, let's just assume it's a sign and trade here or something along those lines, but basically a financial trade, not just a waive and sign for the vet minimum or something like that. Let's just say that's where we're going with this. Again, we don't know. It'd have to be centered around something where it's like CP3 and filler plus Conley, and I'm thinking like a Kyle Anderson. And I'm thinking the reason that both teams would want to do this is for the Suns, like you said, you're getting off that salary cap edge there. And if you are going to, you know, and I know you're kind of staying in that similar range, I think Conley, his $24 million is non-guaranteed. I don't know how exactly they'd structure that. Again, we are not Bobby Marks. This is not some crazy in-depth financial podcast. But in terms of the fit, I think CP3 does something for the Timberwolves that they desperately need. And that's they need a veteran leader to get in there and let them have a deep first-round playoff run. You know what I mean? They need to take the first round to at least six games, maybe seven if they're lucky. And I think CP3 gets that done. I don't think Conley has that potential or that ceiling. For the Suns, you are still getting a really valuable veteran, you know, a point guard who can either lead the second unit or, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with campaign here. Maybe Conley's a starter, but he's a role guy. He knows his role. He knows how to fit in. With Kyle Anderson, you're getting some wing depth. You're getting a little bit of post depth. So that's just kind of where I'm going with that. So, I mean, that's your team there. How would you feel about CP coming to the Timberwolves?
You're wild for this. I don't know what I've done to you in the past. I don't know what I'm going to do to you in the future, but you're absolutely wild for coming in here with trying to sell me on a safe little Volvo for my team to trade for and his giant contract. I don't know what's the matter with you, man. You got to at least make him like a classic Corvette or something, but you're trying to sell me a Volvo for pennies on the dollar when my team is already cap strung hard as hell to begin with. We still got to re-sign Ant. We still got to re-sign McDaniels. And now you're trying to sell me 38-year-old Chris Paul. Get this out of my face. I don't know what's the matter with you, man. Again, I don't know what the thought process is. Like, if I was doing a sign and trade, the one thing I looked at when we were looking at something in terms of getting an adult in the room, I wanted to kind of rehash what he did when he was traded to the Oklahoma City Thunder for Russell Westbrook. And the big thing for that is I want to send him to Orlando. When you look at the Orlando Magic, they've got obviously a platoon of young guys. They don't have a ton of vets. Obviously, you've got like Mo Wagner in the room, I guess, if you're looking for like a really solid guy. You had Terrence Ross, but you actually sent him off to Phoenix this season as well. I want somebody to come in, and it's got to be sending one of those younger guards to Phoenix, probably with some cap filler. Maybe if they want to take a flyer on somebody like Jonathan Isaac, somebody who can kind of provide more defense and give them a little bit more of what they lost when they traded Mikal Bridges. So if it's Cole Anthony, if it's Jonathan Isaac, some filler based around that. And then you get CP3 in a room with Markelle Fultz and Jalen Suggs, and you get the benefit of that veteran leadership with two young guards with a ton of potential. Markelle, obviously, a little bit more offensive focused. Suggs, a little bit more defensive focused. Obviously, if they end up bringing Grady Dick into the fold, that Suggs-Dick combination would just completely benefit over the leadership of Chris Paul. I want if he's going to end up going to a team in the twilight of his career, I want it to go to a team with a lot of younger guys. But ultimately, I don't think it's going to be a sign and trade. Honestly, man, it's going to be the Lakers, isn't it? He's going to the Los Angeles the Lakers
on my list here.
Yeah. And they make the case, man. It's a dark, dark timeline, but obviously they don't want to re-sign D'Angelo Russell for an large amount of money. If you can get Chris Paul for a similar contract for a couple of years, he wants a ring. And that's the one tarnish on Paul's legacy is he hasn't gotten to that ring. He's been addicted to the NBA Finals ever since he got there, but he's only gotten there once. So I don't know what qualifies as addiction in that book, but If you want him to make a trip back to the NBA Finals, he wants to do it with his boy LeBron James. And I think that's what's on the horizon here.
I think you just made the case for me right there. It's LeBron. That is the case. It's LeBron. And it's also, it's the ghost of, when was that failed trade? 2011? 2010? The one that David Stern vetoed?
Shot down, yep.
Shot down. I mean, it's just it's all of that wrapped into one. No one wants to see it. I don't want to see it. But it's what I do believe is kind of the leading favorite here. It would require D'Lo not being re-signed. I believe they would have to decline Beasley's contract right there. But I just think, I mean, you look at what Schroeder provided for them, which is a scrappy, defensive minded, get into the other team's head. I'm not here to be the number one scoring guy, but I'm here to be a difference maker. I think Chris Paul is the ultimate version of that. And I think he's still got that left in him. I think he is a focus, you know, he's focused. He is a winner. Well, I wouldn't say he's a winner, but he's a winner. And he enough so that when you get into the playoffs, he's going to take that shit seriously and LeBron's going to trust him. And I think to have LeBron's trust, I think that's the number one thing that, you know, you can have for a team like the Lakers. And that's where I think the argument is that's his boy. They trust each other. He wants to win. I mean, he's 2004 Gary Payton all over again. And 2004 Gary Payton, as we talked about in the role player draft last time, was a very valuable player for that Lakers team that ultimately lost to, you know, shout out Molly, the 2004 Detroit Pistons. So I think the Lakers are a great fit. I think that's where he's going to end up going. But I don't want to see it. You're right. That is a dark timeline. I'm not here for it. I'm not here for it at all. But the pick and roll between him and AD would be phenomenal. And as we saw in the playoffs this year, LeBron is no longer, I'm not saying he can't do it, but he is no longer that heliocentric, give me the ball, high screen pick and roll. I'm just going to do everything. I mean, he played off ball a lot. He was essentially a 3-and-D wing that then picked his spots to be the number one contributor there. So I think that's a great call. Another one that I really like here, and again, I'm not the first to bring this up, but I think this is a great fit here. It's the San Antonio Spurs, and you brought this up with the Oklahoma City thing that, you know, Chris Paul did, where he clearly proved he was a mature leader. He was willing to do the right thing on that team. And I think the only thing this doesn't accomplish is CP's chance to win a ring. So maybe it's something where Greg Popovich goes, hey, you know, you've got 1 year left on your deal. Come here for 1 year. Obviously, we have a great organization, a great infrastructure. We've got the most potentially impactful rookie in the last 20, 25 years coming to our team who needs a point guard, who needs a veteran point guard. And they do not have a point guard on that team, really. I think fit-wise would be phenomenal. You gave me a little bit of a shocked look here. Are we still stuck on Josh Primo? What's going on here?
I'm just tired of the Trey Jones slander as a Minnesotan boy. I think he's done a phenomenal job. But as you said, it's really going to come down to what Chris Paul wants to do at the end of his career. Does he want to focus on mentoring the next generation, or does he want to win a ring? And that dichotomy and that choice is going to impact what his legacy will likely be. And it's going to impact the league as a whole probably for next year. Obviously, I would love to see him more as a mentorship role, but I don't know, man. It'd be fun to watch LeBron and AD and Chris Paul play 20 to 25 games together throughout the regular season just because of how banged up they'll get. But then coming to the playoffs and fucking murder everybody. I think that'd be very, very exciting to watch. It'd be great basketball. And like you said, that the pick and roll combinations are endless around the league. Obviously, Wembanyama and AD, maybe a little bit more exciting than Wendell Carter Jr., but I get it. I absolutely get it.
The one reason I like the Spurs deal, just kind of real quick, is Spurs, for the most part, should have the money to kind of absorb CP. I think there might have to be a little bit that goes back out. But one thing that I do think the Spurs have that some might want would be Doug McDermott. I think he's the exact type of player that the Suns could have in their lineup. 3-and-D spacer with size, perfect role player. So I think the Suns would have some motivation there to get that done. What do you think? Speaking of LA, I tried looking up Clippers trades here, and I couldn't really justify it. What do you think about the fit of CP on the Clippers?
Well, I've seen it before. I wouldn't have a big problem seeing it again. But like I said, it's,
they signed Blake Griffin to the vet minimum as well.
Oh, just bring back DeAndre Jordan.
DeAndre back, dude. Just run it back one more time.
Hire JJ Redick as an assistant coach. Get Matt Barnes in the building. Yeah. Like, let's just get the band back together. If we're gonna go back to basics, let's get it all back to basics. It'd be interesting. It doesn't scream excitement to me, honestly, because I liked what Russ did on the Clippers, I think, a little bit more. He was really fun to watch in the playoffs. It's going to be interesting what happens with him this offseason as well, and we'll obviously talk about that down the road. But I don't know. For me, it's he either stays with Phoenix, he's going to go to Los Angeles, or he's going to go somewhere where he can mentor a young core. And that's basically the three options. One thing that we've talked about is him going out east, Celtics, Milwaukee. Sure. Doesn't excite me.
Can I stop you real quick? I looked at those as well, and I couldn't really figure out Milwaukee because it would involve some Chris Middleton trade. I don't think Milwaukee wants to do that.
For sure.
I looked at Boston, and again, I don't really see the fit there, especially when they have those three guards that they need to figure out what they're going to do with Brogdon, White, and Smart. So I don't really know what's going to go on. But one East team that I really did look at here is Philly. And I think that the argument could be made that either A, Joel Embiid's going to need a pick and roll partner if James Harden goes back to Houston this offseason, which for the 9th podcast in a row, I have no idea why he would go back to Houston, but that's neither here nor there. They're going to need a replacement. I don't know if Maxey is that exact type of role. Maxey's awesome. I'm not at all dissing him or anything, but I just think he has a slightly different skill set here. I think you can bring Chris Paul in. He can be that pick and roll partner with Joel Embiid. I think automatically that keeps you in that second round of the playoff potential there. And I think if you need to make the money work, I think what would happen is Tobias Harris would find a new home. And I think while I don't know if the Suns would do that, because again, their main motivation to get off CP seems to be the hard cap with the apron coming up. But if you could involve a third team there, find Tobias a new home. Get CP to Philly. Phoenix gets either some cap relief or maybe a light protected first or something like that. I could see a fit in Philly.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be one of those things. Again, this is going to be a really interesting offseason to see how all of these teams that thought that the cap was going to continue to go up and up. It's going to be real interesting to see how all of those teams typically react to all of these guys going down the road. Obviously, one thing I want to talk about as well, saw earlier this week, Brett and Steve didn't really talk about this later or earlier in the week, but Tim McMahon on ESPN came out and said that the NBA is considering giving NBA coaches a second challenge. And this is something that I really want to get your thought process on. Obviously, the challenge I think is good for the league. I know they're still trying to figure out the kinks in terms of when's a good time to use it. But right now, the current context of it is if you use it, you lose it regardless. And you only get one per game. Obviously, that might be a thought process in trying to make the game faster. Obviously, with all the replay review that goes on in the NFL and other challenges that take place throughout there, we want to make sure that game moves faster. We're seeing that with Major League Baseball, with how fast those games are going this year. We want to make it more exciting, more engaging, and have less stoppages. But what do you think about a second challenge, man? What What's your thought process?
I am so team second challenge. I am team the way the NFL does it here. And you look at baseball too. Baseball, you know, they adopted the ability to challenge a call, and their games have not been affected negatively at all. I don't think there's a downside to this. Outside of the fact that it is a little bit of interesting to have that strategy come into play at the start of every game, where if there's a questionable call halfway through the first quarter, you can tell those coaches are sitting there going, man, do I stop my guy from getting foul number two, you know, with 4 minutes left in the first quarter? Or do I save that challenge for something down the road? And then you see that happening later in the game, where a questionable call will happen with 8-9 minutes left in the fourth quarter, or even 4 or 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And you see some of those coaches sitting there going, nope, I'm going to save it. I'm going to save it. But then it doesn't ever come back into play, you know, and just the strategy behind that can be pretty interesting. But ultimately, I do not believe it is enough of reward to just not lose your timeout if your challenge is successful. I think you need to be rewarded more than that. Now, whether that's a second challenge or whether that's just the ability to retain your challenge, I think ultimately that's kind of a similar solution, but that needs to come into play, because in basketball, there are too many 50-50 plays. There are too many subjective calls. And to just allow each team one challenge, and then even if they're right, lose that challenge, I don't like that. I think you can, if you're worried about timing, if you're worried about stoppage of play, you can figure out how to cut things out elsewhere. You know, you can figure out coordination of TV timeouts, or maybe each coach has one less timeout in the first half or something like that. I'm not quite sure. Maybe it's one challenge per half. I don't know, but ultimately it is not enough of a reward to just retain your timeout if you win a challenge.
Absolutely. What do you think? And I think you're right with how the NFL does it. And ultimately, I think if you're going to include the losing of a timeout as a punishment for losing your challenge, I think you need to revert to sort of an NFL style in terms of how they do that. I don't know if it's whether capping how many timeouts you get in a certain half so that way you can regulate those challenges a little bit more. I don't know if it's if you do it like you do in the NFL. If you win your challenge, you get to retain that challenge and use it again. Maybe it's something like that where we still keep it at one challenge, but if it works, you can keep using it. You can only use it a maximum of like two times. Like maybe it's something like that. You still have that ability to sort of regulate how you challenge, because obviously you don't want guys after every questionable call going around the court, twirling their fingers around, telling guys to take a look at it, which we've seen a little bit less in this finals and through the later part of this playoffs as well. But really, when it comes down to that, you need to figure out a way to regulate it so it doesn't get out of control. But I'm with you, man. We need to get ourselves a second challenge for sure.
That's one of my favorite aspects of basketball these days, is watching the players start doing the twirling of the hands to indicate, please challenge this coach, and seeing which coaches go, nah, I don't trust you. Nah, not doing it. Nope. Sorry, Grant Williams. Don't care about you at all. Not going to do this. And then also seeing which players do it, and you look at the coach and they go, fuck, I have to do this now. LeBron's telling me to do this. I'm Darvin Ham. I have to do this. I'm sorry. Even if I don't believe in it, I have to do it. That's a fun aspect that we have with this. But yeah, ultimately, and even if it's like, hey, in the regular season, we'd still need to keep the time tight here. No change in the regular season, but come playoffs, maybe you get the ability to retain your challenge one more time. You know, maybe just a slight adjustment like that is all we really need here. But yeah, I think we're on the same page here. A second challenge needs to come into play here.
Absolutely.
And we've got one more thing that we want to touch on here. There was one more player in the news this week besides Chris Paul that went a little wild on Twitter. 2019 draft class is not looking good so far. But the main person I want to talk right now is my boy Zion. You know, we've got a 22-year-old, a 23-year-old, given $200+ million, living in New Orleans, and recently, and you know, Ethan, let me know if you've heard about this or not. But recently, someone has been reaching out on Twitter, you know, claiming that Zion likes to spit in her mouth.
Oh Jesus, Ether! We talked about this before we got on the podcast. Obviously,
we're Mikey's not here.
Normally, Mikey's our horn dog connoisseur. I appreciate it coming from you, but it can't come from you. It's got to come from Mikey. We'll save it for the next podcast. I'm sorry. I know he's working on car stuff. I know you're all riled up. I know you've done your background research, and I don't want to shut you down, but we're out of time, man.
I'm sorry, folks. We're going to get into Zion mouse spit talk in the next pod. I do apologize. Ethan is shutting us down. if you are disappointed in this ending, DM Ethan, ask him why is Adler not allowed to be bricked up on the pod. With that, we want to thank everyone for listening. We want to shout out the A-Team real quick. We want to shout out producer Mikey. We want to shout out everyone in the Overstated. This is super fun to do with you guys every week. It's been awesome to do this with you, Ethan, recently. And, you know, we've got some fun stuff coming up here. We've got the draft coming up. We've got some possible draft experts who are going to be chiming in on that as well. We've got some fun off-season talk. And ultimately, thanks for being here with us.
Absolutely.
Till next time.
It's been real, baby. Peace.
Peace.